A man leaves a bar visibly drunk and makes the decision we would all want him to make. He does not drive. He climbs into the driver's seat of his parked car to sleep it off, leaving the engine running for the heater. Keys in the ignition. The car never moves. An officer finds him there and arrests him for driving under the influence. Can that conviction stand? It can. The statute reaches anyone who operates or is in actual physical control of a vehicle. And a man asleep at the wheel of a running car has the present ability to set it in motion, which tells you what kind of topic this is. These crimes do not punish something you did, they punish a situation you are in. Here's the root. First, possession. How merely having something becomes a criminal act, the line between actual and constructive possession, and why mere presence never gets there. Then, intent to distribute, and trafficking, where weight does the work. Then, DUI. Two independent routes to conviction, and the breath versus blood rule on refusing a test, and throughout, one method, because this topic hands you the statute. Start with a puzzle. Criminal liability normally needs a voluntary act, and possession looks passive. The law bridges that simply. Possession becomes an act when you knowingly obtained the item, or when you knew you had it, had a real chance to get rid of it, and chose not to. Model Penal Code Section 2.014, and most states follow it. So a dock worker who agrees to hold a friend's duffel bag has not possessed anything yet. He unzips it at midnight, finds bricks of a controlled substance, and leaves it in the closet. That is the moment. Not when he took the bag, but when he learned what was inside and kept it anyway. Now the vocabulary. Actual possession means the item is on you. Constructive possession means it is not on your body, but is within your control. Drugs in your locked glove box. A gun in your nightstand. The doctrine exists so people cannot dodge liability by keeping contraband an arm's length away. And then, the limit fact patterns test constantly. Mere presence is not possession. Constructive possession takes four things. Knowledge the item is there. The power to control it. The intent to exercise that control, not just the theoretical ability. And some link beyond nearness. Ownership of the space, exclusive access, an incriminating statement, or the item in plain view among your belongings. Quick challenge. Your client is a front seat passenger in a friend's car. An officer opens the closed glove compartment and finds methamphetamine. Nothing ties your client to the bag except where he was sitting. Possession or not? Not. Riding as a passenger where drugs are found is never enough by itself, because seat location supplies neither knowledge nor control. Compare a loaded handgun in the nightstand drawer beside your own bed. Never on your body, but squarely within your dominion. That is constructive possession. Possession can also be shared. Two people jointly possess an item when each knows of it and each has the power and intent to control it. Cocaine, open on a shared kitchen table both roommates freely reach. Lock it in one roommate's private safe, and only she possesses it. The mental state is usually knowing. You must be aware you have the item and generally aware of its character. But you need not know the precise identity of the substance. A courier who knows the parcel holds some controlled substance is guilty, though he thought it was cocaine and it was fentanyl. And willful blindness counts as knowledge. Deliberately refusing to look inside a bag you strongly suspect is not ignorance the law rewards. Watch a statute do its work. The Franklin Controlled Substances Act, Section 401, makes it an offense to knowingly possess a controlled substance without a valid prescription. Three elements. It is a controlled substance. The defendant knowingly possessed it. There was no valid prescription. Each is a separate off-ramp. Borrow a jacket without knowing the pills are inside, and knowledge fails. Produce a genuine prescription, and the third fails. One unmet element is enough. Add an intent to distribute, and simple possession becomes far more serious. Intent lives in the mind, so the state builds the inference from circumstance. Does the stash look like personal use or like a business? Quantity beyond a user's supply. Many small baggies. Scales and cutting agents. Bulk cash in small bills. A customer ledger. And no pipe or needle anywhere. 200 grams in 50 knotted baggies. A residue-dusted scale. $4,000 in $20 bills, and a notebook of first names beside dollar amounts. That is a business. 3 grams of marijuana with a glass pipe and no cash is a user, and the distribution charge should not survive. Trafficking is the top tier, and it changes the game. The Colombia Controlled Substances Act, Section 415, makes it trafficking to knowingly possess 28 grams or more of a controlled substance, regardless of any intent to sell. And the weight includes any mixture containing a detectable amount. Two features do all the work. Weight is a strict liability element. So the state proves he knowingly possessed the substance, and that the amount, in fact, met the threshold. Not that he knew it. And mixture pulls the filler in, so a 40-gram package that is 75% cutting agent and 25% heroin is still 40 grams, which kills both natural defenses. It was all for me fails, because the statute drops intent to sell. I thought it was 20 grams fails, because the threshold does not care. Defenses here mostly work by knocking out an element. I did not know it was there negates knowledge of presence. I did not know what it was negates knowledge of character. I could not control it defeats constructive possession. A prescription or license answers a statute that builds authorization in. Some jurisdictions also allow a fleeting possession defense for contraband held briefly and solely to get rid of it. And entrapment, duress, and mistake of fact still apply. Now the second half. DUI, DWI, OWI. The label changes by state, but the offense has one shape. A person operates a vehicle while impaired by or under the influence of alcohol or drugs. And there are two independent ways to prove it. The impairment theory asks whether the ability to drive safely was actually impaired. No number needed. The proof is driving behavior, field sobriety performance, officer observation. The per se theory asks only whether the blood alcohol concentration was at or above the legal limit. Actual impairment is irrelevant. The number alone is the crime. The Franklin Vehicle Code, Section 812, writes both in. Guilty if you operate or are in actual physical control of a vehicle, and either you are under the influence to a degree that impairs safe driving, or you have a blood alcohol concentration of 0.08 or more. That "or" is the whole point. A driver at 0.06 cannot be convicted on the number, but can be if visibly impaired. A driver at 0.10 is guilty on the number, though perfectly steady, and the number itself moves. The adult limit is 0.08 in every state except Utah, which uses 0.05. A commercial driver is at 0.04. A driver under 21 faces zero tolerance. A very high reading, commonly 0.15 or more, triggers an enhancement. So 0.04 is under the adult limit and still convicts a commercial driver. Back to our sleeping man. The act element is operating or driving, but many statutes use the broader phrase actual physical control. And that reaches somebody not driving at all. Read the statute's verb before you assume the car had to move. 3 more points. Drugs count, including lawfully prescribed medication, because the crime is driving while impaired, not driving on an illegal drug. So a prescription is a defense to possessing a drug and no defense to driving impaired by it. Second, DUI is typically strict liability or a general intent regulatory offense. The state need not prove you intended to drive drunk or knew you were over, which produces the most heavily tested point in the topic. Voluntary intoxication is never a defense to DUI. It cannot be. It is the very thing the statute punishes. Involuntary intoxication is different, and a genuinely spiked drink can be a defense. Third, testing. Every state has an implied consent law. By driving on public roads, you are deemed to consent to chemical testing after a lawful DUI arrest. Refuse, and you face an automatic license suspension, and the refusal can be used against you at trial. But criminal consequences for refusing collide with the Fourth Amendment. A breath test is a valid search incident to a lawful DUI arrest. No warrant needed, and a state may even make refusing one a separate crime. A blood test is more intrusive. Police generally need a warrant, and a state may not criminally punish refusing a warrantless blood draw. If the driver is unconscious and cannot blow, exigency generally permits a draw. Either way, the administrative suspension survives. Watch that swap. Fact patterns quietly substitute blood for breath to see whether you notice the criminal refusal penalty just became invalid and the escalations. A first DUI is often a misdemeanor lifted to a felony by a named aggravating fact. A very high reading, a prior conviction, a child passenger, a suspended license, or injury to another. When impaired driving kills, the DUI becomes a homicide, and there are two causation models. The stricter one makes the state prove the impaired driving was itself the proximate cause. The broader one needs only that the defendant was under the influence and that operating the vehicle caused or contributed to the death. The Olympia Penal Code Section 630 is the broad model, and it says driving with due care is no defense. But even the broad model has a floor. Quick challenge. A drunk driver sits stopped at a red light, entirely stationary, when a speeding truck runs the light behind him and kills a pedestrian. His car never moved. Guilty under Section 630? No. Because Section 630 still requires that the death would not have occurred but for his operation of the vehicle. This pedestrian dies from the speeding truck no matter what he does. The but-for link breaks. Change it to a child darting in front of his moving car, and it holds. A word on authorities. This episode named no cases, and that was deliberate. These offenses are pure creatures of statute, and this topic is unstarred, which means the exam will usually hand you the governing law and ask you to apply it. That is good news. You do not memorize every drug code and vehicle code in the country. You need a method. So if you keep only 3 things, keep these. Read the whole statute and split it into numbered elements, because a single unmet element defeats the charge. Circle the mental state word knowingly, recklessly, or none at all, and decide which elements it modifies. And when the statute defines a term, possess, operate, actual physical control, mixture, that definition beats your intuition every time. Now the traps, straight from the examiner's favorites. 1. Mere presence near contraband or being a passenger is not possession. 2. Under the per se theory, the state does not have to prove the driver was actually impaired. The number is enough. 3. Voluntary intoxication is never a defense to DUI because it is the crime itself. 4. A state may criminalize refusing a warrantless breath test, but not a warrantless blood test. 5. Trafficking weight is usually strict liability, and mixture language pulls inert filler into the total. 6. Actual physical control can convict a parked, even sleeping driver. 7. A valid prescription is a defense to possessing a drug, but not to driving while impaired by it. One more that is easy to miss under pressure. Ownership is not possession. You can possess what you do not own, and own what you do not possess. Fact patterns lean on that gap constantly, usually through a defendant insisting the drugs belonged to somebody else. Time for the quick check, and this one comes straight from the Bargo question bank. An officer stops a driver who is weaving badly across lanes. Field sobriety tests go poorly, and the officer smells alcohol. But a later breath test reads 0.07, just under the limit. The Vehicle Code Section 812 makes a person guilty if they operate a vehicle. And either they are under the influence to a degree that impairs safe driving, or have a blood alcohol concentration of 0.08 or more. Can the state still convict on a 0.07? Option 1. No, because a reading under 0.08 conclusively establishes the driver was not impaired. Option 2. No, because the per se limit is the only way to prove a DUI charge. Option 3. Yes, under the impairment theory, using the driving and the field sobriety evidence. Pause here if you want a moment. The answer is option 3. The statute offers two independent roads, and falling short on one does not doom the case. The 0.07 closes the per se route. The weaving, the failed tests, and the odor of alcohol open the impairment route. Option 1 treats a sublimit number as proof of sobriety, but the threshold sets when the number alone convicts. It does not certify anyone as unimpaired. Option 2 forgets the statute's own or. Read the conjunction. It decided the case. There are 30-plus more questions on this topic alone, each with every option explained like that. 5 things to take away. 1. Possession becomes an act when you knowingly took the thing or knew you had it and could have ended it. Constructive possession needs knowledge, power, intent, and a link beyond nearness. 2. Intent to distribute is proven by circumstance. Baggies, scales, cash, and ledgers say business. 3. In a weight threshold trafficking statute, weight is strict liability and mixture counts the filler. 4. DUI has two independent routes, impairment and per se, and actual physical control reaches a driver who never moved. 5. Voluntary intoxication is never a defense, and a state may criminalize refusing a breath test, but not a blood test. Which is why our man in the parking lot is convicted. He did the responsible thing and still had present ability to set that car in motion. Read the verb the statute chose. Next time, inchoate crimes and parties. Practice this topic with more than 2,900 exam-style questions, free to start, at nextgenbargo.com. This episode is for education and exam preparation only, not legal advice, and we are not affiliated with or endorsed by the NCBE or any bar examining authority.